I'm Peter Ayers, and you're listening to Stages, the podcast that converses with creatives.
Correct. Craft. Oh, we started now. Yes.
Yes, of course we've started.
I've been working at the Playbox Theatre, and I'd worked as an ASM on a show, a Louis Nara show, The Golden Age.
The golden years of Hollywood. That was what I loved.
Absolutely don't profess to be good at it at all. I could study and I could be much more diligent in my homework.
So in a sense, you know, I think really good directors are really good editors.
I was really incapable of going on, not just as a writer, but I felt as if I was incapable of going on as a human.
One more day before the storm. And Trevor says, stop. He said, you look like little Lord Fauntleroy, dip the wig.
They swooped in and just... Every scene I had with all those different people, they just made it work.
But after some time, I realised that grey comes in many, many hues.
I've had the luck, and without the luck, I know plenty of entertainers out there that are wonderful, funny, just never had the breaks.
I'm what I would call a dancer's dancer. Like, all I ever wanted to do was dance.
You've got a better memory than me, that's for sure.
Oh, I've done my research. I've cheated.
And you'd had a little piece of paper there, mind you, so have I.
We both had pieces of paper, so that's been
all right. I wasn't silly, was I?
No, I think it was great, yeah. Thank you, Sheila.
Thank you, Peter. God bless.
Hello, I'm Peter Ayers, and welcome back to Stages. Any fan of the musical theatre in the 80s and 90s will no doubt recall the powerhouse performances delivered by Jodie Gillies in a string of blockbuster entertainments. She created roles in a number of premier Australian productions, all of which earned her kudos as a performer of terrific skill and exquisite sensitivity. Who could forget her turns as the waifish Eponine in Les Miserables, the determined Florence Vassy in Chess, or the passionate Giulietta Trapani in Andrew Lloyd Webber's Aspects of Love, a role she performed in both Sydney and Melbourne. They are but a few of an extensive resume in musical theatre, following her professional debut in the iconic Victorian state operas The Pirates of Penzance. She commanded the stage in productions of Company, Man of La Mancha, Camelot, Lipstick Dreams, and Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. Now residing in London, Jodie joined the Stages podcast via Zoom to reflect and celebrate a triumphant career in the theatre. How are you, Jodie Gillies, in London?
I'm very well, thank you.
How long have you been then in the great city now?
Just over 4.5 years. I came here in July of, I think, 2019.
And you enjoy it? It'll be a change of pace to old Sydney town.
Well, actually, for the previous 10 years, I was living in Shanghai, China. So I haven't lived in Sydney for a very long time.
But you're a Sydney girl, aren't you, originally?
I am. I am indeed. Balmain, born and bred.
Being in London, I guess you get to see lots of theatre.
Well, that's one of the reasons I've retired, let's call it retired here. After living in Shanghai for 10 years, we got a few shows through, you know, Western musicals and things to watch, but not very much. And I actually got to do some work there, which was really exciting, but I missed being able to go and see theatre on a regular basis, even if I wasn't doing it anymore. So I decided it would either be New York or London, where I spend out my cronage years watching theatre.
Do you miss it when you see people up there doing it?
Sometimes I miss it, but to be completely honest, what I really miss about theatre is the camaraderie and creating something together and the feeling you have backstage, the way you have to become very close and intimate and comfortable with each other very quickly is a very unique thing in the world, I think, in the world as a job. And I really miss that.
Yes, because you completed some big gigs in Australia during the 80s and 90s. You were in some juggernaut musicals that hit the country.
Yeah, I was very lucky to have the kind of voice that worked for all those big Andrew Lloyd Webber things and, of course, Les Miserables and then some Sondheim. So I was really lucky to be born at the exact right time for that to be fashionable.
We'll talk about them, of course, during this conversation. But tell me about London theatre. What's hot at the moment? What's worth seeing?
Well, I thought Hadestown was fabulous, actually, and I had seen it on Broadway with the original cast, who were absolutely phenomenal. And the London production is very, very similar, but I found some of the characters really drew me in that hadn't drawn me in before in this English production. So I was really quite astounded by it and absolutely love it. I love the music. The opening bars, even just, you know, I started bopping in my chair. It's wonderful.
I saw it in New York in January. I saw it. And it's the most magnificent staging, isn't it, of a musical?
Oh, it is. But also just the music is just, oh, I just love it. Every time I see it, I get goosebumps.
And what else? Have you seen The Guys and Dolls?
I've not seen The Guys and Dolls. I think I've seen Operation Mincemeat, which is a musical based on the true story of Operation Mincemeat, about three or four times. Because it's wonderful, and I'm thrilled that they've finally got a West End gig, because it was playing in little theatres sort of out of town for a while, and it's something like a six-hand. They play like 30 characters in it, and it's just hilarious and beautiful.
Yeah, people are raving about it, so hopefully it gets a wider life.
You know, I think it's something Australian audiences actually would really appreciate.
Good. Well, fingers crossed for that one. You haven't had a chance to see Trevor Ashley and Priscilla the Party yet, have you?
Not yet, but of course, the darling Trevor's stayed at my house for a while, so I'm well in contact with Trevor now. He has his own apartment now, but yes, we had quite a week with there where I thought I was going to die, because every night was a party when you've got Trevor Ashley living with you.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
And what about the National? Do you go off and see many legitimate theatre, straight plays?
I see a lot of stuff at the National, because actually my apartment overlooks the National. So it's my local theatre. It's my little local that I just go, oh, yeah, what's on today? And I look down the list and see if there's any tickets available, pop over and grab one and see whatever's on. So, yeah, I see a lot at the National. And I see a lot of straight stuff. In fact, I saw Billy Crudup the other night in Harry Clark, which was phenomenal.
You'll have to get a gig as an usher.
Oh, I think that's asking for trouble. I'd be up there on that stage telling them what they're doing wrong, darling.
Do you still have a sing?
Oh, I occasionally have a sing. In fact, I got up when Trevor first came to town. He did a gig at a cabaret venue called Crazy Cox, spelt with a Q. And I got up and had a little bit of a warble with him. We did I Know Him So Well together, but in a comedy fashion, and that was great fun. So every now and then I blow out the cobweb, so to speak.
Oh, good to hear, good to hear. It never leaves you. So growing up in Balmain, Jodie, what were the artistic influences for you? Did you have a family that took you to the theatre?
No. I just used to, as a child apparently, I used to mimic and imitate and sing along with everything on the TV, male, female, instruments, everything. So I've just always had an obnoxious nature and a loud voice.
You would have grown up like me with Young Talent Time, I guess. You tune into that every week?
Not so much. No. I didn't watch Young Talent Time. It's odd. Actually, the Don Lane Show was a big influence on me, and all of that wonderful variety that we used to have in Australia but we don't have anymore. And seeing all those great acts, you know, Kerry Bedell and Ricky May, and all of those people are the people I sort of grew up with on the local stage seeing. But it wasn't until I was in high school and I had formed a Shakespeare club, basically to get out of maths, but that's another story. And I was doing Shakespeare and serious stuff, and there was a school excursion to see Chicago with the great Nancy Hayes and Geraldine Turner, and having only seen Seven Brides for Seven Brothers and West Side Story and those wonderful classic musicals on TV, I sat in the audience, and when Geraldine Turner opened her mouth and sang like that, I went, that's what I want to be, that voice, because I'd never heard that voice before in a musical. And from that day, I was like, oh, my God, I want to be that.
And you ultimately eventually got to work with both of those ladies, didn't you, in company with Geraldine and Summer Rain with Nats?
Yeah, I did, and it was wonderful. It was a bit, it was one of those moments where you were kind of gobsmacked and didn't know what to say. So it was wonderful, wonderful experience both times.
So was there much school drama happening for you? Were you able to express yourself that way with musicals at school?
Not with musicals so much, but we certainly did plays, and I was very active in the Shakespeare Club, so I was in all the Shakespeare's that they put on, or usually as the boy, because I had short hair at an all-girls school, so that, you know, that's what I got put into, the boys' roles. But that was fine because they were often better in Shakespeare, let's face it. Yeah, and we did it weirdly. We had a drama teacher who did a stage mounting of the script of The Getting of Wisdom, that wow. Australian movie.
Yeah.
And yep. I played the lead in that, which was really interesting. Very active with acting, not so much singing, other than we had a wonderful music teacher who heard me singing one day, and even though I wasn't studying music and didn't know how to read music, well, that's not true, I played the trumpet, so sent me off to the music camp as a singer. And at this music camp, the New South Wales Talented State Music Camp, I got to explore jazz and rock as well as musical theatre, and that really gave me a chance to try other forms of singing, which was really, really great for me, actually, and helped in a lot of ways when I went into some of the musicals that had that more rock sound, you know, pop sound.
Yeah, it's a big voice. It's a unique voice, a versatile voice. How do you nurture it and grow it then? Do you start singing lessons?
I've never had a singing lesson in my life.
Really? You and Tony Lamond?
I'll take her as my company any day of the week. Of course, she's the OG musical theatre star of Australia, isn't she, really?
Yeah, absolutely.
She was doing it before the business.
So what about vocal care then? How do you know it just comes? It's innate, is it? It just comes naturally.
Look, I'm awful. Anyone who's worked with me will explain to you that I am absolutely annoying because I don't even really warm up. And I used to walk in during their warm ups and go, "Yep, it's there," and walk back out, and they'd be so angry with me. It's just I was really blessed with a natural set of pipes, and that's what it is. And then I played with them. I imitated things and mimicked things and tried everything and tried everybody's different sounds of voices and explored it and kind of found my own just by, you know, experimentation, really. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the fact that you're able to mimic voices also indicates that you have great innate musicianship also. You've obviously got a very good ear.
Yeah. Funnily enough, I can look at a sheet of music and play it for you on the trumpet, but I can't sing it for you. So I learn everything by ear also. So I have a very quick ear.
Did you grow up with cast recordings in the house?
No.
No, nothing like that?
No. No. Dean Martin and Scottish bagpipe music and Bing Crosby and a little bit of the Beatles.
After high school, you studied the Nepean course of theatre.
Yes.
So was acting always in your vocation? You're going to be an actor, not necessarily musical theatre?
I was never going to be an actor. I was very good. I was top of biology and agriculture. And I was going to be an agricultural scientist specialising in the genetics of animal husbandry. And I went into a singing competition, sang a song for 3 minutes and won $1,000. In my final year of high school, and said, this racket seems kind of good. Maybe I'll try that. And auditioned for Nepean and got in, and that was the end.
Doing what comes naturally.
Exactly.
There's a great role, often, Annie, get you your know, gun.
Yes. There's so many great roles I would love to have played but haven't and probably never will now, but there you go. That's life. Some doozies, so I'm quite happy.
doozies indeed. So what do you learn at Nepean in that training course for what, 3 years, I guess?
It was 3 years. It was very acting focused, and we did a lot of the history of theatre as well. So we went, you know, right through absurdist, Ibsen, obviously Shakespeare. We didn't really do musical theatre. We did have a singing teacher there to help people who... Because, you know, even in straight plays, sometimes there is singing. So to help people get over nerves of singing and performing music. And we had the wonderful Mariette Rupps Donnelly was our movement teacher. So that was great. So we had little bits and pieces of all sorts of things. We had Bogdan Koka from Poland came and taught us mime and theatre of the body, physical theatre. And we had our other professors teaching us voice. We had Malcolm Kay, who was, strangely enough, I've reconnected with. He was a child actor on Coronation Street. So he was teaching us voice and TV technique. So we had all sorts of little units of stuff, but not necessarily anything other than concentrated theatre acting for most of the time.
Mariette Rupps, of course, made a big splash with Evita.
Yes.
Yeah, and then you got to work with her in Company.
It was so funny. It was so funny because there were all these people who I'd, you know, seen on the television who were stars, and I had to work with them, and I was kind of doing a whole fake it till you make it, I belong here kind of thing, and secretly inside was going, oh, they're going to find out that I'm just a girl from the suburbs, you know. But fake it till you make it, I did.
Well, the first big show that you made was The Pirates of Penzance after graduation. Yes. In 1984. Yes. So that was your professional debut?
It was, and I was a booth singer. I wasn't even on stage.
I assumed you would have been a sister.
No, I was initially a booth singer and a swing cover.
Right, right.
And I was terrible at it. I'm a terrible swing. I barely remember my own lines, let alone, you know, learning the whole rest of the cast. It was absolutely awful. So the next year they put me in on stage because I was so terrible at the swing.
How was you had an audition, an agent upon graduation, I guess, who sent you for the audition? Yes. What was that audition like, first time in front of a professional creative team?
I can't really remember, other than I went in and sang as loud and high as I could, because at that point I was auditioning, I think, with Poor Wandering One as cover, and I was second cover to Mabel, second cover to Marina. So that's how I was singing in those days, as well as the other stuff. But, yeah, I just sang as loud and high as I could, and they gave me scales to go up on the piano, and I could hit the F sharp above top C. So they were like, yep, good, she'll be good in the chorus as cover. Yep.
Did auditioning ever become easy? No one ever enjoys auditions, I guess, but some people do. What's your opinion of them?
It didn't become easy, but as I became more familiar with the people behind the desk, I became a lot more easier about them judging me, I suppose, and knowing what I could do. You know, when you've got Michael Tyack sitting behind a desk, he's one of the loveliest humans on earth, as well as being an absolute genius musical director. It's lovely and it's comforting. And, you know, John Robertson's a friend after a while. And so it became nice because it was more friends behind the desk rather than, oh, these people don't know you, I have to really impress them kind of thing.
Did you experience much rejection early in your career? I mean, once it took off, of course, the shows came after one another quite quickly.
I experienced rejection all through my career, actually.
Really? Yeah. You went for roles definitely. And missed out. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I think any person in theatre will tell you that you're always too something for the role. And, you know, it's a very personal thing to be rejected for yourself rather than for your voice or your art. And that's always how it feels and always how it happens. So all throughout my career I experienced rejection, but you grow a very thick skin, you know. And if one of your friends gets that role, then, of course, you're thrilled for them, which soothes you a bit, you know.
Yeah. You're talking earlier about there is no other career like acting, how, you know, in the workplace you have to form that incredible, immediate, intimate bond with a company for the length of the run. But also, as you say, what other occupation goes through as many job applications effectively and experiences so much rejection? Yeah.
Yeah, it's probably the most awful part of the job because, you know, after Pirates and then I did Camelot, so I became known as really solid, loud, which was important in those days when we didn't have those mics that were right next to your mouth. Girl who would always turn up and do the job kind of thing. I was going to a lot of auditions. I was going to two auditions a week, so that's two rejections a week kind of thing.
Yeah. Eight shows a week also is required. Yep. Were you a party girl at that time? I mean, we're all a bit in our youth. We like to sort of do the show and enjoy letting our hair down afterwards. Were you a disciplined performer earlier on or at any time?
No, well, not really that disciplined. Although once I was doing lead roles, I became very disciplined. Because, so it's very different when you're in the chorus.
Yeah.
You can fudge a bit or your voice can be croaky or whatever. But once you're in a lead role, you become a nun. And you don't drink and you go home straight after the show and you go to sleep and you don't. I got married during Les Mis and I was at one point when I had vocal strain, I was walking around with a notebook around my neck writing to my husband because I couldn't talk to him because I was on vocal arrest other than the show during the week. And he quipped, you know, oh, I married my favourite singer in the world and I can't even sing around the bloody house. Well, in an American accent, but yeah.
Yeah. Yes, now that's been described many times. It's leading a company is like a monastic lifestyle. It's the show is the thing. You know, there are so many people relying on you to deliver every night.
Yeah, and the pressure can be quite palpable to make sure that you are on. You know, if you're the lead role, like there was a time in Chess when I had a terrible pneumonia, but I kept singing and I was on the stage, you know, because the pressure is there. If you're not doing it, audience go, you know, they make that announcement and the audience go, you know, the role of da-da-da will be played today by, you hear that sigh. And you don't want audiences to feel like that. So, yeah.
Yeah. Those first couple of shows, Pirates and then Camelot, you're working with some legends of the theatre like June Bronhill and Richard Harris. Is that intimidating?
Richard Harris was intimidating because of his way. He was a very odd and unusual man. Lovable sometimes and absolutely incorrigible at others. June was divine. And one of those women who speaks with that very lovely, you know, she's from the opera, very lovely voice. And then she turned around and with the mouth fouler than a sailor, tell you an anecdote. And it was extraordinarily funny because she was actually, you know, she's the girl from Broken Hill. She wasn't really that opera diva. And every now and then it would come out and I'd love it.
Yeah, yeah. She was a great lady. Did you have a go-to song that you would often pull out for auditions?
Oh, yes, I had a couple and sometimes I'd do them just to watch people's faces. I used to do I'm Not Going from Dreamgirls, but I'd do it in a really difficult key and they'd open up the sheet music and I'd say, in a pianist's face, look at me, and with the crestfallen eyes and all the sharps, and laugh evilly to myself. But yeah, often it would be I'm Not Going, obviously on my own once I'd done Les Mis, just to remind people I'm that girl, you know. But it depended on what the show was, because then I did some shows that were quite different to that. So yeah.
Well, all through the career, I mean, there's a variety of styles and composers. Gilbert and Sullivan, Lerner and Lowe, Sondheim, Schoenberg and Babil, Terry Clark and Nick Enright, the boys from ABBA, Bjorn and Benny. Do you have a favourite composing team that you've worked for? Not necessarily the people, the genre.
I still think to this day that there will never be music written as passionate and emotionally moving as Les Miserables. And I had the luxury that they came to Sydney and worked with us. And Claude Michel in particular for me was so wonderful in helping me through the role and express the emotions. You know, he was more about the emotions than the notes. So he was wonderful. So as an experience, I would say that. But obviously Sondheim is the greatest music I've ever sung.
For an actor, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And I guess at heart, I kind of still am an actor, really. I would always call myself an actor-singer, which people laugh about, but yeah.
Well, let's talk about Les Mis. The Juggernaut musical, which was taking the world by storm and then announced that it's coming to Australia, and I'm sure every young female singer had their eyes on Eponine. When did you first hear about Les Mis?
I heard about it when the soundtrack first came out and someone handed me the cassette and said, you should do this. It might have even been John English. No, John English was the one who said, you should do chess, which I eventually did. But, so, of course, I memorised it way, way, way before the auditions.
And what was that the audition entire like? Role. What was the audition like? What did you have to do? Tell me, lead me all the way through it.
You're talking 35 years ago. I can barely remember what I had for breakfast, darling.
What did you sing? Do you remember?
I sang on my own. They asked us to learn part of the song. They asked us to learn part of the song.
Right.
I was reasonably privileged enough, having just done Company, and I did a tour of Australia with the Glenn Shorrock Show. So I was privileged enough to be asked to come on audition for the role, which I did, and was told, and this is one of the secret stories of Australian theatre, but I'm now going to expose it, that I could have the role if I lost 20 kilos.
That was explicitly said to you?
It was in contract.
In the contract, wow.
Yes.
Wow. Such different times.
I had to get down to 55 kilos.
Right.
Which I did. Yes. The final audition was wonderful because Trevor Nunn came out and did the final audition and said, yeah, that girl. But then they had another girl in reserve in case I didn't make the weight, like a jockey.
Like a jockey, yes. I hope there weren't weekly weigh-ins or anything like that.
No, there weren't. And, in fact, when they saw what I looked like when I came for the costume fitting, they went, oh, my God, stop losing weight, because they'd measured me against Frances Raphael, who was 5'2", and I'm 5'6", and a very different build, and I was clearly underweight and unwell.
Does that weigh on your mind throughout the season as you're playing the role, sort of being conscious that this is in the creatives' heads, that you need to make a particular weight?
It was at first, but yeah. They made it very clear that that was a mistake and they wouldn't hold me to that anymore, which was fine. And it's a very active role too, you know, climbing up and down those barricades every night. It kept the weight off.
Eponine dies, of course, in the show. You're doing that 8 times a week. It is one of the most magnificent musicals ever written. But what was it like psychologically doing that every night? Were you able to keep a happy face? How did you de-roll from the show at the end of it?
Honestly, I didn't.
Right.
And it was, by the end of the week, my eyes were red and bloodshot, and you only have one day recovery. And I'm sure I was an absolutely miserable person to live with because I took it all on. I was very kind of method-ish about the role. So, I didn't shed the role for a year.
Wow.
And then went into an equally depressing role, which is hilarious.
What did you go into next?
Aldonza in Man of La Mancha.
Oh, of course, another big sing too. I mean, a bigger sing, really, than Eponine. Yes. Yeah.
More
yeah.
rags and bruises.
Obviously, the show keeps you fit, but did you have any other regime outside the show that would maintain your fitness for 8 shows a week?
Not really. I know most of the other people would go to the gym on a regular basis, but I didn't really do any of that kind of thing. I was much more worried about being able to sing 8 shows a week, frankly, because I think I might have been the first person who sang Aldonza all in chest.
Right.
Up until that point, it had been a Sopranos kind of a role.
Suzanne Steele.
Exactly. Yeah. And the reviews did not favour me very well in comparison to Suzanne Steele, but I did it my own way.
And that's the way to do it, isn't it?
Well, I didn't know any other way to do it, you know, so that's just the way I approached it. And I also approached it that she wasn't Dulcinea, so she shouldn't have that voice. She was Aldonza, so she should have the voice of a street urchin grown up to be a whore.
Yeah.
No, not a pretty girly voice.
Yeah, absolutely. Guts, a voice with guts. Did you read reviews through your career?
I tried not to, but, of course, I snuck them every now and then.
You can't help it, can you?
And my parents would find the good ones and show them to me and show them all around the neighbourhood and to everyone who would listen or look, they would show them to. So I got to see the good ones all the time, not always the bad ones. But I heard about them.
Jodie, were you superstitious in the theatre? Did you practice any of those? No.
No. And in fact, that is another thing I used to annoy all my colleagues with. I would walk in on the first night at the half hour call and go, "How about Macbeth?" Throw salt over their shoulders and run around in a circle. I'm an annoying person to work with.
Annoying person. What was your dressing room like, your dressing table? How did you like to keep that?
A mess. Absolute mess. Absolute mess. All sorts of crazy gear. I went through all the different phases. I went through like a 1960s phase and I had a lava lamp on my desk and all sorts of crazy stuff. Not very serious about being off stage at all.
But the dressing room is, apart from your own house, that's the other space that you inhabit so often, don't you, especially in long runs?
Well, Les Mis is a 3.5-hour scene. You do 2 shows a day. You spend almost as much time in that dressing room as you do at home.
Hmm.
And I shared that dressing room with Marina, and we had an absolute ball, actually.
Yeah.
And Philip Quast was in the dressing room next door, and he would die and come downstairs and have a shower and sit in his dressing room and wait for the bows. And then I would die and come downstairs and have a shower and wash off most of the dirt and wait till I came on as a ghost. And we'd talk to each other through the wall after we were dead. And one day
he said, "I can't
hear you properly." He was like, "I can't hear you properly." So he had weights in his dressing room, arm weights he used to practice. And he banged a hole through the wall. And then every night he'd come down, and after I died, he'd go, "Jodes," and he'd pass through this hole in the wall he'd made, this little glass of port, and we'd have a little port together and talk about how the show was that night and whatever. And then, oh shit, I'm going to go up and be a ghost. And I'd run up on stage and do that last little bit of ghost thing. And then he'd come on and, we'd both had a couple of ports before the bows. Some of the bows some nights were deeper than they probably should have been, but that's the theatre.
Was Les Mis your longest run?
I think it was. I only ever did 1-year runs, to be honest. But I did a year in Man of La Mancha too. Oh no, because I went back to Les Mis in Adelaide. I did about 3 or 4 months in Adelaide. So yeah, that would have been the longest run. If you went them both together.
How tough is it doing a long run when you're doing the same thing 8 times a week and, you go out that wing and you pass that actor as they're coming on and you...
Yeah, it's like that cartoon of the coyote and the sheepdog stamping in before they, go into work, and then they get on stage and they're a whole different person, and then you go back off stage and you're you and you go back on and you're a different person. And some nights I would wake up literally halfway through on my own and go, shit, which verse am I at? It's become so much a part of your soul that you don't realize you're doing it and you lose track of time. And I look down at Peter Casey with terrified eyes, thinking he could help me, telling me which verse I'm at. He couldn't. He was just waving his arms, conducting the orchestra. And I'm like, I think I'm in the second verse. I don't know. I'll go with it.
Theatres are very special places. They are effectively our temples, aren't they? They're a very they're a wonderful spiritual place to be in. And mm-hmm. and one, I guess, for you in Sydney was the Theatre Royal, because you had 3 big successes there with Chess and Les Mis, of course, and Aspects of Love.
Yes, I did 3 really big shows there. I've only been in 2 dressing rooms there though, so. One of the dressing rooms just really feels like my home there, or did anyway.
Florence Vass.
I will never forget the smell of the matinee air conditioning pumping in the fumes from the car park. We'd been inhaling lead petrol before we'd go on stage. Delightful. Perfect conditions for singing.
Oh, dear. Did you enjoy playing Florence in Chess?
Oh, that was my favourite role to sing.
Yeah.
I have to say, the hardest, most demanding, and my favourite role to sing. So exciting, such an exciting score for a woman to get to sing all of that pop stuff and very quiet moments and those big moments. And I loved it, absolutely loved it.
And a chance for the Aussies to do their own production also, directed by Jim Sharman.
Absolutely. And so Tim Rice came out and rewrote some lyrics for us and rewrote a little bit of music for me, because I could sing higher than anyone else has. So put a little bit in the beginning for me. And yeah, it was fantastic production, really different production, and working with, you know, some of the greats, Jim Sharman, of course, from so many things, but of course the director of the movie, Rocky Horror Show.
Of course, of course. Look, a lot of people say, and including, you know, I've spoken to Tim Rice, who says that it is a flawed show, and they've tinkered with it for many decades now to try mm-hmm. and get it right. Do you feel that? And if so, what do you think is the problem with Chess?
Oh, this is a controversial one, because I've talked about this a lot over the years. I still think it's one of the greatest scores
it is.
Ever written.
Yes.
And I think, for me, I think the fatal flaw of the show is making it big. I don't think it should be big. I think it should almost be a small chamber piece, because it's about people manipulating each other to get what they want, emotionally, sexually, financially. And if it was played in a smaller theatre with a smaller chorus and a smaller band, I think, and the audience closer to you, I think it could be something really special. And paired back the way they're doing with musicals now. Pair it right back. Get rid of the glitter and the big moving set pieces and make it about the people. And then I think it would be something really exciting.
Well, that's something hopefully you've certainly seen with Sunset Boulevard. Did you see that production in London where they...
I didn't get to see it. It had such a short run. But I saw the Oklahoma.
Right,
which
yep.
was also very pared back, and was blown away by it.
Because you can concentrate on those characters, the people and the story more intimately.
Well, I didn't realize half of the stuff that happened in Oklahoma, because it was so dressed up with the pretty frocks and the beautiful singing and the lovely sets. And when you see it pared back, there's racism and sexism and, you know, homophobia and latent, you know, possible homosexual tendencies, and all kinds of stuff comes out. Mm. It's quite extraordinary. It's nothing like the movie with Howard Keel and Shirley Jones that I was brought up on.
Yes, no, different farmers and cowhands there.
Certainly.
Giulietta Trapani in Aspects of Love.
Yes.
A delightful musical. That was, again, an Australian version, wasn't it, here, directed by Gail Edwards?
It was. Gail reimagined it in a very different way. And I actually got to play Rose as well. So I was very lucky that I got to play both roles.
And an Australian actor who had made a great career in the West End, Kevin Colson.
Yes,
Kevin Costner would have been nice, but Kevin Colson.
I mean, I would have been on stage every night, you know, absolutely for sure, ready to kiss Kevin Costner.
How was it working with Kevin Colson?
Lovely. Although when I was playing Giulietta, you don't have as much to do with him as when you're playing Rose, but he's a lovely man, very private, very lovely.
So we've talked about some big names that you've worked with as co-stars and as directors. A lot of them, I imagine, would have been terrific teachers, or people that you considered great teachers. Who are the great mentors and teachers that you've had through your career?
Well, I think Gail Edwards has been one, and she really broke a lot of glass ceilings, I think, for women as directors in Australia. And when I did Les Mis, of course, she was the associate director and Trevor Nunn was the director, and he was also a great, great influence on my career. The rehearsal period we had for Les Mis was the most extraordinary thing, because it was like something like 9 weeks. And the first week he said, put the book down. We're not doing anything with the book. We're just improvising and working together and building trust. And it was wonderful to have Trevor Nunn, you know, give you a masterclass for a week in acting. Yeah, not bad.
Not bad at all. Yeah.
Not bad at all. Michael Tyack's been a great influence on my career as a musical director. He's such a steady hand and such a kind musical director. I always appreciate the fact that he gets to the point, but he does it in such a lovely and kind way. You know, he'll tell me when I'm not singing something right, but do it very nicely, which is always appreciated.
Nowadays, we see a lot of Australian performers heading off to work in New York on Broadway or in the West End. It seems so easy nowadays, which is fabulous. When you were performing in the 80s and 90s, there was there any consideration that you might take a role to the West End or New York?
Well, I did actually go to New York, and I did my one-woman show there,
right.
The other woman, which I'd done in all around Australia. And then I stayed there for a while and auditioned, and I got very close to getting the national tour role in Secret Garden of, I can't think of the name, Martha?
The maid?
Yes. I got very close to doing that, but they wanted an American, obviously.
Yeah.
So I didn't get that, and I ended up abandoning that. I was there for a year auditioning and trying out for stuff, but as an unknown, it was very hard.
Yes. So at least you can say you've done it.
I've been there, done that.
Yeah, yeah.
I performed off-Broadway.
Of course, as well as those big musicals, Australian musicals also have been part of your career, with things like King of Country and Summer Rain, of course.
Yes.
Great that we can tell our stories through the musical theatre form. How'd you go with the Australian musicals?
I love them, and I always wished I'd had the opportunity to do more because, strangely enough, it's quite odd singing in your own accent. I know that sounds strange, but most things are written for different accents. So when you sing in your own accent and you sing words that are Australian words, particularly in King of Country, there's, you know, so many place names. I can't remember them now, but they were like Nulla, Canumble, and things like that. And singing those words, which are part of your own home vernacular, was really interesting and somewhat difficult sometimes because it just didn't roll off the tongue the way all the things I'd grown up with hearing did. But I loved them. I loved doing both roles. I really loved King of Country. That was a great fun role to do. I got to do a little bit. I got to do the demo tapes also of another musical. Oh, I can't remember the name of that now either, about a preacher, Eulalia Horn. And I did it. There was a special on ABC TV called Once in a Blue Moon.
Yes, I'd say. And you did some stuff on that, I saw. Yep.
Yes. So I did a couple of numbers from Australian musicals and that. And that was a fantastic show to be part of.
I think Jonah Jones, you did a number from that. And
We did Cardigan Street with Nancy Hayes again, you know, legend.
The musical about the preacher, was that Miracle City?
That might have been it.
There was a Max Lambert and Nick Enright musical.
No, this wasn't that one, no.
Right.
No, the female was the evangelist in the one that I did, but I can't remember the name of it.
Right.
Anyway, it was
as
was
you
fantastic.
Say, it's 30 years ago.
She rose above it. Look, I'm teetering on the edge of senility, darling. I can't remember these things.
Well, it's wonderful that you were able to remember what you did remember in this conversation. It's fantastic. look, it was wonderful to see you work in Australia in those many, many musicals that you did. I know a lot of people are going to enjoy listening to what you've been up to and pine that you're not performing anymore, but we can be happy that you are happy in retirement.
I am happy in retirement. I'm thinking about coming out again. We'll see. I did some great stuff in China. I got to do Fun Home, which was great.
Fantastic.
And I got to be a professor of musical theatre in China, which was also wonderful.
So you taught?
I did. I taught young adults Western musical theatre while I was in China, which was great fun. And there were some really talented kids there. And that was a very exciting thing to do too.
So theatre is big in China? If they're
it is.
Training.
It's becoming bigger and bigger, actually. And in fact, I did vocal. I was vocal coach and supervisor for the first all Mandarin production of Little Shop of Horrors. And that was exciting too. And, there's some stories I could tell you there, but I'm not going to. We don't. we don't know who's listening, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, absolutely. So did you learn Mandarin?
I learned very little. My sons are fluent in Mandarin, or they were, but I learned what I would call taxi and bargain Mandarin, all the things I need to catch a taxi and get a bargain.
Well, maybe you can do a cabaret show reflecting on your stellar career.
This is something that has been mentioned to me, so it has been floated. We'll see what happens. Keep your ears peeled, because I think there might be something happening soon.
Great. Bring it back to Oz. We'd all love to see it.
Okay. Bring the old girl back.
Yeah. Jodie Gillies, thank you so much for this conversation. It's been absolutely wonderful.
Thank you too, Peter.
And have a lovely day over there in London. And I'm going to bid you good night.
Yes, you're having nine nights and I'm about to have breakfast and a lovely cup of tea. How English of me.
What a treat to talk to Jodie Gillies, a voice that is so indelible for fans of the musical theatre, fortunately kept alive through a series of recordings issued by Jodie throughout the years. And we always have YouTube. Take a look. Thanks to my guest today, the supremely talented Jodie Gillies. Thanks for joining us in this episode. You can check out all of the episodes featured in the podcast thus far by visiting our website, www.stagespodcast.com.au. I'm Peter Ayers. Keep well, keep warm, stay safe, and I'll catch you next time on Stages.